All right. Again, thank you all for joining us here today. We are looking at Mark chapter 10. We're starting in verse 32, and we are hopefully going to get all the way to verse 45. I anticipate we'll probably get stuck a little bit before 45, just based on how much material I know I have and how these things tend to go, but that's all right. We'll start with the first section here, and that's we started this a little bit last week, but we'll read it again, verses 32 through 34. And Jesus is talking about his third prediction concerning his crucifixion and resurrection. So let's consider what he has to say here. Now, they were on the road, going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going before them, and they were amazed. And as they followed, they were afraid. And he took the 12 aside again and began to tell them the things that would happen to him. Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him. And the third day he will rise again. Okay, so, you know, we talked about how we've transitioned from one section now to another, at least in this middle section of Mark. And so we are looking here at this idea, and I want to look at this map here. You know, I love these maps. This is a map of the region, and if you remember in the last slide, it takes about 10 hours to get up, a little over 10 and a half hours to get from the Jordan River near Jericho to Jerusalem. And so that's about as long as it'll take him to get there if he decides to go straight there. You know, sometimes he stops and talks and whatnot. So it could potentially take 10 hours. He might stop somewhere. And of course, at the same time, from what I understand, the road was very windy, very meandering and whatnot to get there. So it likely would have taken a good deal longer. But at least 10 hours to get there. What I want you to look at right here is what's in the upper left of your screen. This is the elevation, the altitude that he is going to travel. He's going from this low point, perhaps the lowest point in the region, and he is going to go up to one of the highest. It's not the highest point, obviously, in the region, but it's one of the high points. Jerusalem was up on a hill, and so he is, or up on in a high elevation. About it says 805 meters. Times that by 3, roughly, and you get as many feet as that is. So about 2,400 feet. And so he's going up, straight up, basically to Jerusalem. And I want to think about that for a second. You know, his eyes, he had set his eyes to Jerusalem here. Now, keep in mind, he's on his way to Jericho, looking at the map now. And you can see the scripture references for where he is. And he's on his way down to, he's about to go to Jerusalem, but he has his eyes, when he's making this prediction, he has his eyes set to Jerusalem. And I want you to imagine for a moment just being in his shoes. You know what's about to happen. I mean, you're the Son of God. You're Jesus. You know what is going to happen. You look up the road, knowing that this is the last time that you'll be on this road, knowing the pain and the agony that you will soon face. You know, you now face this daunting uphill climb, every step bringing you closer to the cross. His disciples, we note here in verse 32, they're amazed, they're afraid. Jesus has been telling them this whole time what's going to happen, yet they're still fearful. They're still quite afraid about what's about to happen. Jesus somehow sensed this. He either could tell it from his just by knowing these men and knowing how their reaction, or maybe he could read their thoughts. You know, there's different ways where he could have figured this out. He took the 12 aside to speak with them further. You know, other manuscripts have a slight word change, suggesting that the others who followed them were the ones who were afraid and not the 12 themselves. But then he only speaks to the 12 on what is to come, what's to come. The language here suggests that these things would shortly come to pass. These things are going to shortly come to pass. So there's up to Jerusalem. And now let's consider the prediction. In any event, I'm not sure, you know, looking at this, you know, I don't know how what he says here in verses 33 and 34 would actually allay any of their fears. It wouldn't me. If I were afraid and thinking about what was about to happen, I don't think I would necessarily be afraid or I would be calmed or comforted by these words. But I'm not them, and maybe it did. But I want to consider that for just a second. So let's consider the prediction here about what Jesus says here in verses 33 and 34. Again, Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. And again, he says that he is to be betrayed. We talked about that in the last prediction, because that's something Jesus revealed. You know, this is the same word that also means to deliver up. So the concept of betrayal, as we understand it, may not have been understood by the 12 apostles at this time, especially since Judas is one of the ones who heard this, both this time and the last time. So the chief priests and the scribes were the ones to whom he would be delivered, it says here, the chief priests and the scribes. And who sat in such places of authority? Well, that was the Pharisees, right? The Sadducees as well, but the Pharisees held a greater or a great position as well. He reveals here that he was to be condemned to death. So he would end up having some kind of a trial. If he's condemned, then he's judged. There must be some kind of a trial. And obviously, if he's condemned to death, the outcome is bad. he would be delivered to the Gentiles, it says. Of course, these were non-Jews, and based on what we know of the time and place, those Gentiles were likely the Romans. And of course, we know, because we're familiar with the story, that it was the Romans. The Jews would deliver him up to the Romans to be crucified. The sect in league with the Romans was, of course, the Herodians, right? So, if you recall, all the way back in Mark chapter 8, verse 15, be careful of the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees. Of course, that's referring to their teachings and their hypocrisy, but at the same time, be careful of these people. They were plotting to kill Jesus. Again, we saw that all the way back in chapter 3. Jesus also adds on that he would be mocked, that he would be scourged and spat upon. The torture and the humiliation he was going to face. He adds on in this particular instance what's going to happen. Then he would be killed. And truth be told, though, he says that wouldn't be the end of the story. His death would not be the end of the story. He would then rise again on the third day. Now, my question to you, based on our understanding of what is being read here and what we've read and what we've studied in this section and up to this point, would this have calmed your fears? Would knowing any of these things have calmed your fears? What might you have been afraid of if you were in the disciples' shoes? You know, and you could feel free to comment on here for that question. And of course, you know, I'll ask Sam if he has any thoughts on that. Sam, what would you be afraid of in this situation? And would Jesus' words have helped?
I think I would have been thinking, if they're going to do that to him, what are they going to do to me? There's followers, right? And, you know, that would have been, you brought up the point that Judas is in the audience, right? Judas is one of the 12. He's there listening to all this. And Jesus is not only seeing the cross, he's seeing all the events of the cross, and he's seeing Judas betraying him. And you know, what's going through everybody's head? I mean, in Judas, we have some indications that at some point he gives up on, you know, on following Christ, right? Because obviously he betrays him to the Pharisees and he's killed. But at some point, Judas stopped being a disciple, a follower, and abandoned his Lord. And of course, everybody else ends up running away too. And Peter ends up denying him three times. And so they're all, you know, I imagine they had a lot of fear and trepidation with what he was saying. I wouldn't have thought it was, I mean, the rising from the dead, of course, they didn't understand, right? They didn't have it, even after it happened, they didn't understand it. So I don't know if that would have comforted them as much as confused them.
Well, you mentioned Judas, not to mention his betrayal, but before his betrayal, he was a thief, as we read in, I think in the gospel, in John's gospel, we read that.
Yeah.
So he is he is one of the apostles. He's up there with the other 11, but he's not going to stay there, right? So let us, so some of the things, some of the thoughts I have here, perhaps this talk was scaring you or was scaring them. Or maybe you didn't really believe it. I mean, you've heard, you might have been told a lot of things. And, you know, sometimes I hear about predictions and things of that nature, and I don't always believe them when I first hear them. And then they happen. You know, we talked about this morning about how many times do the pundits and whatnot and the analysts, how many times they try to predict things politically or what have you. And how many times do they get it right? Well, sometimes when they predict something, I don't always believe them, partly because of their track record. But of course, Jesus' track record is flawless. So why? So even then, though, this is something that seems amazing and almost outrageous. Why would you believe this? And so maybe they didn't really believe it. Again, this talk may be scaring them, like, oh man, I don't know about that. This is a little bit too much. But maybe you did believe it, but you weren't sure. And again, as Sam said, and I completely agree, how was this going to apply to you? How does this apply to them? You know, if they're going to kill him, there's no promise of my resurrection, just of your resurrection. And that's great for you, but what's going to happen to me? You know, there's that level of selfishness that might be there. And to be fair, it's understandable. I mean, I certainly would have that question myself and could very well be afraid of it. He was going to be taken, beaten, mocked, and killed. What would happen to them? There's, again, no promise of a quick resurrection for... There's a promise of a resurrection, but no promise of a quick resurrection for the disciples. Dan has a comment here. It must have been very unnerving to Jesus' followers to consider that their leader would be killed. When you cut off the head, the body will die. That would leave them vulnerable. But he rose again, and the body did not die. It flourished in the form of his church. And that's exactly right. And so, in fact, Gamaliel makes that point in Acts chapter 5, right? That the heads of so many rebellions and movements that happened in the past, when they were killed, when they died, their movements fizzled out. But of course, not so with Christianity. But at the same time, you don't know that's going to happen. You think that, oh man, he's going to die. That again, leaving them vulnerable and trying to figure them, and they wouldn't have the same clout, I suppose, that Jesus did. All right. So, again, there's no promise of a quick resurrection for them. So we'll see, of course, in the next section that they still didn't really understand what Jesus was talking about anyway. Not in the slightest. They still didn't quite understand what was going on, or they didn't believe it. And so we'll see that in the next section here. All right. And so this next section, of course, Mark chapter 10, we're going to look at these positions of authority is what we're going to see here in verses 35 through 45. So let's read this section here, verses 35 through 45, and see what happens. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant us that we may sit on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They said to him, "We are able, indeed." We are able. So Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink the cup that I am that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. And Jesus called them to himself and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Okay, so looking at this, the first point I have on here is the question. I have a lot of verses up there. So the question, we note that the disciples, they just don't get it. They don't understand what's happening here. Recall what happened when they were arguing with each other on the road about who would be the greatest. Remember all the way back in chapter 9. All the way back, it was just the last chapter. What did Jesus say and what did he do? He told them in verse 35, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." In other words, they just didn't get it. Then he presented before them a child, saying that even those as lowly as children ought to be received, we see in verse 37. The disciples, again, they obviously didn't get it, because not too long after that, they rebuked those who brought children to see Jesus. And Jesus rebuked his disciples for attempting to turn them away. We see that a little earlier in this chapter, verses 13 through 16. In fact, what did he say in verse 14? "For of such is the kingdom of God," right? In other words, the kingdom of God is full of little children, is like little children. Not necessarily literally, although could potentially be literally, but people who are like little children in certain aspects. Then after a discussion on riches, making it impossible to enter into heaven without God's help, he repeats the idea again. In chapter 10, verse 31, "Many who are first will be last, and the last first." The disciples do not make the connection. And we see this plainly here. The disciples, they just don't make the connection here. Therefore, two of them, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, ask a question of Jesus about having high positions of authority in his kingdom. Matthew records, adds a little detail here, records that James and John's mother was involved in this discussion as well. And of course, it's likely Zebedee's wife. So, if you've never been a teacher, or if you've ever been a teacher, I know Letha's probably watching. Hello, Carrie. Good to see you. If Letha's still watching, she might know what this is like. If you've ever been a teacher, especially in today's society, you will get students with what's called helicopter parents. Now, you might be a helicopter parent. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but it some of them can be certainly a hassle for some teachers. This is a type that are just super involved in their kids' lives, which, again, there's nothing wrong with being involved with your child's life. In fact, I encourage it strongly. But not to the point that they do everything for them. Even trying to convince the teacher to change a grade when the student didn't earn it, or to not be so hard on the child. And yes, I mean, I even experienced this when I was teaching classes in college. Sometimes parents would come to me and say, what about this? there's nothing wrong. Again, there's nothing wrong with being involved in your child's life. And even if you sometimes have to be their advocate and speak on their behalf, there's nothing wrong with that necessarily. But, and in fact, I strongly, certainly encourage being involved in your kid's life. But they must be able to do, especially when they get to college, they must be able to do things on their own because you will not always be there to fix it or to do it for them. And the reason why I bring this up, I get the impression that James and John's mother was kind of like this, was kind of a helicopter parent. She is a believer. To her credit, otherwise, why would she be there? But, and she wants what's best for her children. Again, understandable. But neither she nor her sons really know what that is, really know what's best for them. And we'll see that in a little bit. James and John, they ask this question. They say, do whatever we ask. Do whatever we ask. And Jesus wisely does not agree to that on the spot, but wants to hear the request first. Understandable. I'm sure many of us are like that. Hey, can you do me a favor? Sure, what is it? I got to figure out what it is first before you can agree to do it. And we note that it's a stark contrast. The same question is going to be asked of a blind man a few verses later. In verse 51, what do you want me to do for you? He asks the same question. What do you want me to do for you? How different are those responses? We'll certainly look at the blind Bartimaeus later on, likely next week. But his response is, heal me. Please heal me. Restore my sight. And for James and John, it was put us into high positions of authority. Sam, do you have a thought?
You think about this situation. James and John, were called the sons of thunder, early in Jesus' ministry. You get the idea that they were pretty bold characters, which is really strange when you look at the writings of John, because you don't see that in John, right? In the Gospel of John, of course, was written years after this. John is this very mild, self-deprecating kind of person, won't even refer to himself by his own name. He's the one who Jesus loved, and it's the only way he'll refer to himself. And in the letters that he writes in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, he's just, kindly and gentle and meek, and it's so weird to think of him and his brother going up to Jesus saying, "Okay, Jesus, we want to be your top two generals here when you come through this thing." And of course, they were probably thinking worldly, just like all of them were, that Jesus was going to be another David, as a king in Jerusalem, right? And that they wanted to be his top guys. It's just so hard to see that when you see how John was transformed throughout his life as an apostle in what he wrote, that he would have been this way in his youth.
And we just note how he's so much different. It just shows how much the gospel transforms someone. We note that with Peter as well in his writings and how he changed. We note him especially because of how much he changed between the Gospels and the Book of Acts. There are some similarities, of course. You're not going to change him completely, but there are some stark differences as well. And so, you know, he's just, you know, all in this context here, all Bartimaeus wants is his eyesight. And James and John, they want the highest positions of authority in Jesus's kingdom. You know, it's a remarkable request, since already they, along with Peter, had been shown to be the inner circle, right? The circle of Jesus's followers was broad. Don't know exactly how many there were, at least 70, as we see in Luke chapter 10. The inner circle being the 12, and the inner circle being Peter, James, and John, these three. And so they're already part of this inner circle of Jesus's followers. We see that, the references here in Mark chapter 5, verse 37, and in 9, chapter 2, where he goes and he goes in with to heal Jairus' daughter, or to resurrect her, raise her from the dead. And also in Mark chapter 9, verse 2, when they witness his transfiguration. So why would they think that they wouldn't receive such great positions in his kingdom after being part of his inner circle? And again, maybe they did, but their mother just wanted to be sure. And again, that's my reading of it, and you possibly might have a different understanding there. Hello, Laura Stevens. Good to see you on here. All right, so next, there's some ignorant questions that these two men ask. So there's the questioning, what do you want me to do for you? And so in verse 37, we see what I think are some, verse 38, he says, are you sure you're ready for this? And in verse 39, they say, we're able. You know, honestly, this is why I think it's an ignorant question. They don't understand. They just don't understand. And again, these two men and their mother have no idea what they're asking here. It's clear that they have an erroneous notion of what the kingdom was going to be like, assuming it to be like an earthly kingdom. In fact, as they were approaching Jerusalem, maybe they thought that this was a march to seize power, going up towards Jerusalem to seize power. Maybe that's what they thought here. And eventually they thought Jesus would cast out the Roman occupiers, the Roman occupying force there. We know that they still didn't understand what his death and resurrection predictions meant. Sam alluded to that earlier. So of course they wouldn't understand the nature of his kingdom. Even right before his ascension, they still would have no clue. I have up here, Acts chapter 1 and verse 6. Even then, they didn't understand. Will you now restore the kingdom to Israel, assuming again it's an earthly kingdom? Well, that's not what's talked about here at all. That's not what he's doing. So Jesus asks them a question using a metaphor in verse 38. He asks them this question with this metaphor here. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? You know, in Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane, he would refer to what was about to happen as a cup. He would pray in chapter, and I have the verse reference up here, Mark 14, verse 36. He would pray that this cup would pass from him. Even he didn't want to bear that burden. And yet, James and John are ready to volunteer. I don't think they know what they're doing. They don't know what they're volunteering for. And so when studying how the word baptism is used in the New Testament, we find that it actually describes seven different kinds of baptism. And this is one of them. This is a metaphorical baptism. This is an indication of the suffering he was going to experience on the cross. And you can imagine, some places call it a baptism of suffering. And you can imagine that being the case, that he is going through, he's immersed in pain and anguish, in this awful experience he's about to face. And you can, I mean, I think a baptism is an apt metaphor for what he is going to experience. Certainly a crucifixion could be described like this, not to mention the scourging and the beatings that would accompany it. So, given all that we know up to this point, do you think James and John understood what Jesus meant here? I gave you my opinion about what I thought, that I don't think they understand. But what about you? Do you think that they really understood, given all that we know up to this point, all the predictions that were made and everything, do you think they understood what Jesus was talking about here? Any thoughts, Sam?
I don't think they had a clue. I really don't. And, you know, because if they did, I mean, they were his followers, you know, obviously. And they had seen, they'd been through these situations where people were trying to trap him. I'm sure they sat around talking for the 3 years they were walking with him. You know, Jesus knew they were after his head the whole time. All the Pharisees and Sadducees, I'm sure the disciples did too. They heard the rumors. They saw the situations, times where people wanted to stone him, you know, times where they were trying to trap him. You know, so there was all this stuff going on. I mean, they knew that this was a dangerous situation, but, you know, it seems kind of a bravado, you know, that they stand up and say, okay, we're ready, let's go, you know, when in fact they're all, what, in a week and a half, are all going to run away from him, right?
I'm not sure the time frame of this. It could very well be a week and a half. Just trying to understand the timeline, but we know that it's not far. It's not. Yeah. It's far away, right? Yeah. It's soon. And so, you know, they're going to abandon him. They just don't understand. You know, they might have recognized these as metaphors, the cup and the baptism, but would they understand what it stood for? What Jesus was talking about here? Well, it seems clear that they were making a claim that when tested, they would falter and fail. And as Sam mentioned, they did. They faltered. They failed. They weren't willing to go through all that. At least that's they scattered essentially when Jesus was crucified. You see, that's the kind of men, though, and I want you to think about this. These are the kind of men that Jesus chose to be his disciples. Men like you, men like me, men who would falter, men who would fail, men who want greatness, but who scatter the moment things get tough. It was the Holy Spirit who would give them help and comfort, who would embolden them to preach the gospel, putting their lives on the line for Christ and the gospel's sake. And if they could do it, maybe we can too. Obviously, we don't have direct operation of the Holy Spirit today, but we still have the evidence of that, the indirect operation, if you will, by looking at his word and gaining comfort from what is within its pages. Let's consider now Jesus's prediction here in verses 39 and 40. Jesus's prediction. Jesus tells them that they would indeed suffer a similar fate, even though they do not know what they are committing to yet. We note in Acts chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, it says, "You will indeed," so verse 39, "you will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized." So he does tell them that they are going to suffer in this life. Of course, James, he wasn't crucified like Jesus was, But he was one of the first Christian martyrs, recorded anyway. Of course, Stephen being the first in Acts chapter 7, but he was the first of the 12 to have been violently murdered or executed there in Acts chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. If even one of Jesus's inner circle, these three men, could be killed like this, what hope is there for any of us? At the end of John's gospel, in John chapter 21, verses 18 through 23, there is an indication of how Peter would die and how John might not die by martyrdom. There's, you know, they're kind of vague about it. But we understand through history that he lived and died of old age. But even so, he did suffer many hardships, including exile on the island of Patmos. And we see in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 9, he calls himself a brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ. So he's already in the kingdom. He's already suffering tribulation, and he's a brother and a companion through all of it with all of us. And so, especially with the people that he's writing Revelation to. So this is, he's still suffering quite a bit, even though he did not die by martyrdom. Jesus then goes on to say that such positions of authority are not his to give. Even with all the persecution that they were going to face, there was no guarantee in terms of what reward that they might have. There was, however, some indication that we see in Matthew's account of an earlier event. So in the aftermath of the encounter with a rich young ruler, we read that Jesus said that those who left all would gain so much in Mark chapter 10, verses 29 through 31 that we covered a few weeks ago. Was it last week? Maybe it was last week. But in Matthew's account, Jesus also says in Matthew chapter 19, verse 28, says, "When the Son of Man sits on the thrones of his glory, you who have followed me will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." So, while they had no promise as to what position they would hold in relation to each other, they would still hold great positions of authority. So I find that rather fascinating that they would be so intent on having a position above the other 10. So that leads me to verse 41, and I think we might stop at verse 41 and then continue the rest next week. So verse 41, we see that the disciples are displeased, as you can imagine. They had no doubt overheard what was going on here and were displeased about what they had heard. So, my question now is, how might you feel under similar circumstances? Would you be upset or apathetic? Man, let them do them. I'll have my position of authority. If they get a higher one, that's okay. So would you be upset or would you be apathetic? Would you be loving toward these two brothers, or would you be resentful toward them? So, my question for you, how would you feel under a similar circumstance? I wonder. What do you think, Sam?
I was thinking, when you were talking about it earlier, I was thinking about Peter, because you bring up this, this inner circle kind of concept, and, Peter, James, and John were separated and given special insight and special honor and special, even that, like, for instance, the Mount of Transfiguration. So here you have two of the guys, two of the three, talking to Jesus and saying, "We want your top two posts." I wonder how Peter felt. The other disciples are there too. And of course, they've all been arguing, they keep arguing about who's going to be the greatest. It's apparently a common theme that comes across when they're walking around with each other. But I wonder how Peter felt in all of that. And given his proclivity for boldness and reaction, I would imagine he would have been kind of indignant. And, like you said, I think you did a good job of bringing up the point. These are men. They are just men. They have all the same, you know, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life issues that we all have. So I think there's been a lot of grumbling and indignation in the group.
And I wonder sometimes how I would feel. And the question is, you know, the answer to that, I don't know. I don't know how I would feel, how I would purport, how I would present myself after that. Would I be upset? Would I be displeased? I don't know. So now the question is, why do you suppose that they were upset? So Sam kind of touched on that already. And there are a few possibilities that I see on that. You know, it might be because James and John were trying to undermine the rest of them, trying to cozy up to the boss for better treatment. You know, or maybe they didn't feel like they deserved it. Maybe the rest didn't feel like that James and John deserved it, particularly over Peter, as Sam mentioned earlier, who was with them just as much. Maybe they wanted such positions of greatness for themselves, or they thought the judgeships that they were promised were sufficient. Or maybe the rest were beginning to understand what Jesus was talking about, and they were upset at James and John's attempts due to their lack of understanding. You know, I'm not sure about that last one, but it's a possibility. They were beginning to understand this sort of thing, but James and John were not. In any event, we don't know for certain, but it did bother them to the point where Jesus thought it was something about which he needed to address them all. And so we'll talk about that next time. The next thing here would be greatness in serving. And so that's the next point that we'll look at. And so I hope you'll join us for that. Next time we're going to start our worship live stream in a little while. And so thank you all for joining us here today and for learning a little bit about God's word from Mark chapter 10. I hope today that you will you'll take this lesson and understand it and apply it. And I hope that you'll join us for our next our worship in a little while. So again, please join us. We'll be back shortly. God bless.